Living Fiction. Northwestern University, in cooperation with the National Broadcasting Company, brings you a radio dramatization of another timeless story, Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift, another in a series of Living Fiction.
My name is Lemuel Gulliver. For 16 years and 7 months, I sailed the seas. First as a surgeon, and then as a captain of several vessels. In the year 1699, I accepted an offer from Captain William Pritchard, master of the Antelope, who was making a voyage to the South Seas. Oh, I shall not trouble you with the particulars of our adventures in those seas. Let it suffice to say that in our passage we ran afoul of a tropic storm. The weather being very hazy, we were within a half a cable's length of a giant rock before our lookout spied it.
Rock pole! Rock! Rock pole!
Oh, fast there, man! Then might have launched the longboat.
Six of us made shift to get the longboat into the sea. Just as we cleared the ship's side, she was driven on a rock and split asunder. We rowed until we could row no longer, then trusted ourselves to the mercy of the waves. But there was no mercy in that madness. Half an hour later, we were caught up in a giant swell and dashed into the roaring sea. What became of my companions, I cannot tell, but concluded that they were lost. For my part, I swam as fortune directed and luckily was pushed to the shore by the wind and the tide. I was in so weak a condition from my struggles that I lay down on the grass and fell asleep. Some hours later, I was awakened by a noise like the humming of insects. I tried to rise only to discover my arms and my legs fastened securely to the ground and my hair tied down in the same manner. At once, I became aware of something alive moving on my leg, advancing boldly toward my chin. By bending my eyes downward, I was able to perceive that it was a human creature not 6 inches high, with a bow and arrow in its hands. And even while I looked, at least 50 more of the same kind followed the first. It gradually became clear to me that it was these tiny captors who had made me prisoner, who had bound me securely while I slept with cords no thicker than a thread of silk. Outraged at first by the absurdity of a man of my stature being thus treated, I then began to ponder how like my plight was to that of thousands of my own countrymen, who, too, were bound by invisible threads of caste, custom, and circumstance. Were they not prisoners as much as I? The only difference being that I was aware of my plight, and they were not. The Lilliputians, for that was the name of my tiny captors, brought me food and drink. And as I ate, my anger at these little men trampling so audaciously over my body abated, and I soon fell asleep again. While I slept, I was bound in chains and carted by 1,500 horses to the palace of the emperor. Thus I was presented to the Emperor of Lilliput. Overwhelmed by the presence of royalty, I could only prostrate myself at His Majesty's feet and acquiesce. Impressed by my gentleness and good behavior, the Emperor set me free. He then had a mind to entertain me with one of his country's best love shows. A Redvesel, his Minister of Private Affairs, ascended to my shoulder to interpret the performance for me.
What did you about to witness, Madam? It's the annual performance of our tightrope walkers.
Why, he's splendid. He's magnificent. Bravo, bravo, bravo. Superb. He's colossal. He's a sensation.
He's just me. He's been at it for years. What is it? What do you found?
Well, it just occurred to me. Is this rope dancing really a true test of a man's qualifications for public office?
Perhaps you thought of a better one in your country?
My first impression of the kingdom of Lilliput was that I had never beheld a more entertaining prospect. Surely I thought that these tiny doll-like people, so energetic and so resourceful, must have attained a state of happiness and perfection that we larger mortals only dream of. But I was doomed to disillusion. I had been there scarcely a month when my friend Redrissel came to climb up on my shoulder and began to whisper in my ear.
Did you know that?
Speak louder, Redrissel. I can't hear you.
Matters of state have to be whispered. It would never do to let the people know what's going on. Once again, our two parties, the Tramskins and the Slamskins, are struggling for power.
Is it possible here in Lilliput? Why, how do they differ?
Most profoundly. One party adheres to the wearing of high-heeled shoes, the other low-heeled.
High and low heels.
His Majesty favors lesser heels in his administration. Therefore, the animosity of the two parties runs so high, they will neither eat nor drink with each other.
Is there no hope of a compromise?
Neither party will yield a fraction. However, some have professed to see hope in the progressive attitude of His Royal Highness, the heir to the crown.
And how does he stand?
He wobbles.
Wobbles?
One of his heels is higher than the other. He's been observed to wobble from left to right.
Now, he sounds like a young man most unusually endowed for political leadership.
Alas, it's his father, not he, that's on the throne. Meanwhile, the country is split in two. And at the same time, we're threatened with an invasion from the island of Blefuscia.
Blefuscia?
A neighboring kingdom with which we've been engaged in a most obstinate war for 6 and 30 moons.
6 and 30 moons? Amazing! Even in Europe, we are not often able to sustain our wars that long. What started your war with the Blefuscians?
An egg!
An egg?
Now, it's allowed on all hands that the natural way of cracking the boiled egg is upon the larger end.
Naturally.
The present emperor's great-grandfather, however, during his reign, published an edict commanding all his subjects to break the smaller end of the egg. The people so resented this that there have been 6 rebellious uprisings wherein one emperor lost his life and another his crown. Now the emperor has ordered all the books that do not support the little Indian point of view suppressed and burned.
But how does this matter of the egg affect your country's relations with the Blefuscudians?
The monarchs of Blefuscia find it to their advantage to foment these civil strifes, even sending their spies amongst us.
I see. Well, are the majority of the Lilliputians with the king on the matter of the egg?
Many of them, I'm afraid, have no political opinions at all, so long as they get their egg. I'm afraid some of the younger generation have even forgot what the war is about. Meanwhile, it's to start all over again. The enemy has already equipped a numerous fleet and is preparing to descend upon us.
Well, if there is anything I can do, I would...
His Majesty is placing great confidence in your strength and valor.
I am greatly flattered. Please present my humble duty to His Majesty and let him know that I stand ready with my life to defend his person and state against invaders. When the hour of invasion was at hand, I waded into the channel between Lilliput and Blefuscia, cut the moorings of the enemy's fleet, tied the ship's lines together, then waded back with the enemy's vessels in tow. The whole kingdom of Lilliput awaited on shore to do me honor. alas, I was to learn how fickle is the public mind, how short-lived the hero's laurels. Early the next morning.
Who is it? Confound it, I do not wish to be disturbed.
It's I, Richard Duke.
Oh, very well, I'll let you in. My head feels like a cabbage after last night's celebration. What brings you out so early, Redvisor?
I come under the express order from His Majesty.
What does he want now?
He wants you to bring all the rest of the enemy ships into our port at once.
But, great heavens, that would leave the Empire of Blefuscu entirely undefended.
Exactly! His Majesty proposes to reduce that miserable kingdom to a province and govern it by a viceroy. Not only does he intend to conquer Blefuscu, but he is laying plans to destroy the entire race of big Indians and compel all people to break their eggs on the smaller end.
And if they refuse?
They will be executed.
Why, he's out of his mind. You may return to His Majesty and say that I refuse his request. I shall never be the instrument of bringing a race of free and brave people into slavery.
What is it, Redvisor? Did you give my message to the Emperor?
Mammon, you must leave Lilliput at once.
What do you mean?
Lilliput, His Majesty is angry, most angry at your refusal. He has informed the people that you are a traitor. Articles of impeachment have already been prepared against you. The populace is clamoring for your death. But His Majesty has decided against that. His intention is to blind you instead.
Blind me? What a low, contemptible, mean, sniveling, treacherous, selfish race you are. But you, Redvisor, why are you here?
I could not bear to think of you reduced to this state of ignominy. You are my friend.
You must have come to warn me at great risk.
The risk of my life?
I am deeply grateful to you. Even in Lilliput, among as low specimens of humanity as I have yet encountered, you have proved to me that there are those who are not governed alone by self-interest. I shall not depart from your country entirely cynical. I shall not trouble you with an account of my escape from Lilliput and my eventual return to England. Suffice it to say, I was soon on another voyage, which, after many misadventures, brought me to the kingdom of the Brobdagnigians, a race of giants as tall as steeple spires, whose voices roared like thunderfalls. Among these giants, I was looked upon as a freak. The queen chanced upon me when I was being displayed in a box in the marketplace, and delighted by the fact that I was 30 times smaller than her court dwarf, persuaded the king to buy me for her plaything. At the court, my lot was intolerably humiliating. I became obsessed with the idea of proving to the king and his court that I was indeed a man after all. And at length, I hit upon a way to accomplish this. I offered to reveal to the king the secret of an invention. An invention that up to this time is the most significant achievement of our race.
Tell me, my diminutive friend, what is this wonderful invention?
Well, sire, between 300 and 400 years ago, there was compounded a certain powder, which, when kindled, will fly up into the air with noise and agitation greater than thunder.
What a diverting idea for feast days and celebrations.
Oh, but wait, Your Majesty. Ram the proper quantity of this powder into a hollow tube of brass or iron, and will drive a ball of lead with such violence and speed that nothing can sustain its force.
But might not that prove destructive?
But it will rip up pavements, tear houses to pieces, lay waste cities, dash out the brains of all those who are near.
Stop!
I whom you scorn, know the ingredients of this wonderful powder. I understand the compounding of it. I could teach your workmen the formula.
And what would I want with it?
You could become master of the lives, liberties, and fortunes of all your people, whomsoever disputed your absolute authority.
Are you too ignorant to understand that I neither have nor want absolute authority?
But surely you, a king, you cannot be without ambition. You must wish to live in the annals of your people. Now, by the use of this formula, our Prince of Orange...
Be quiet. I command you. Listen to me. I would rather lose my kingdom 1,000 times over than be privy to your dreadful secret. Some evil genius, enemy of mankind, must have been the first contriver of this powder. If you value your life, never mention it again.
As you will, sire. But it seems to me that...
You speak of power and politics. It is my opinion that whosoever can make 2 ears of corn or 2 blades of grass to grow where only 1 grew before deserves mankind. Does more essential service to his country than the whole race of politicians put together.
I was forced to conclude that the king's narrowness of view was the miserably perverted effect of a limited education. More than ever now, I longed to be among my own kind, among those with whom I could converse on equal terms. Deliverance came sooner than I expected. One day, while I was sunning myself on the beach, an eagle picked me up in his beak, carried me many miles out to sea, then dropped me. I was rescued from the waves by Captain Thomas Wilcox, a worthy Shropshire man. Ah, but such is my restless nature that I had not been home more than 10 days before I...
Man the captain and cast off the stern line.
Aye, aye, sir.
Yes, I was embarked upon another voyage, and it is part of my strange destiny that in time I should have found myself on the island of Laputa. Now, Laputa is a most remarkable place. A flying island suspended several thousand feet above the heads of ordinary mortals. The Laputans, unlike the Brobdignagians, are most scientific. Indeed, they are so wrapped up in intense speculation that they never enjoy a minute's peace. They jostle each other in the street, bump heads, and are often in the manifest danger of falling off of the island. The really great thinkers among the Laputans do not walk about at all, however. But they are put in an institution called the Grand Academy of Projectors. Being a great admirer of projects myself, I immediately asked to be allowed to visit the institution. At the great door, I was stopped.
You pass. Show your identification pass, please.
Mm-hmm.
And your travel permit. Very good.
Where will I find the research laboratories?
You go 1 mile down that corridor, and then turn left, and then right, and then left again.
And the agricultural project?
Oh, you'll find that 2 miles left at the opposite end of the building.
Thank you very much.
Come in.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Chief's in conference, but if you care to see the assistant chief or the sub-assistant chief...
Oh, never mind. I'm merely interested in the aims and accomplishments of this division.
At present, we are concerned with a project that will transform ice into gunpowder.
Oh.
Our laboratories are in there, but I doubt that the layman...
No, I guess not. Well, thank you, sir.
Not at all.
Yes, I am the coordinator of all architectural projects. It was I who first introduced the idea of beginning all buildings at the top and working down.
Aha, my friend, you've been wasting your time with those speculative projectors. We're down to earth in here. Food is our business, stuff of life, you know. I've just perfected a method of plowing so simple, you wonder you did not think of it yourself. Now the farmer plants his field with a crop of acorns, turns a drove of hogs loose in the fields, the hogs root for their food and plow up the field. It's simple, isn't it?
You see, our aim is to perfect a universal language. Now, I hold that by leaving out verbs and participles...
Nonsense, Professor X. You're only wasting your time with minor changes of that sort. So I propose that we abolish words altogether.
No!
Abolish words altogether and carry about in a sack on our backs such objects as are necessary to express a thought. There's your universal language.
But you can't do it, I tell you. They won't let you do away with words.
Who won't let me pray?
Oh, the women, the women!
School of Political Projectors, right through that door.
I propose that as a solution to all political problems, we endeavor to persuade the people to choose leaders for their wisdom, capacity, and virtue. that we teach office holders to consult the public good, that we reward merit, ability, and eminent service, and exhort leaders to place their own interests on the level of their people.
I vote pass.
Yeah, what about that?
Oh, yeah.
Except for the fantastic ideas I heard expounded in the School of Political Projectors, I must say I was impressed with the Grand Academy of Laputa. The only inconvenience is that none of the projects of any of the projectors have been brought to perfection. And in the meantime, the whole country lies in miserable waste. The house is in ruins, and the people without food or clothes. However, I dare say that in time they will get around to doing something about that, too. To the last of my travels, and to that part of my voyage which is the most likely to test the listener's credulity. Oh, not because these adventures took place in a country where horses, called in that land Winnems, are the masters, and men, called Yahoos, are the beasts of burden, but rather because of the profound difference between their conception of good and evil and our own. It took me the better part of a year to gain sufficient respect from the Winnem at whose house I stayed for him to discuss these matters with me. For at first he considered me only a cleaner and slightly more rational Yahoo than those he kept out in the stable. The whole race of Yahoos, he insisted, were the most treacherous and irrational of all brutes.
All you need do is throw among five Yahoos as much food as would be sufficient for 50. Instead of eating peaceably, they will fall to quarreling and fighting, each single one determined to have it all to himself.
Yes, I'm afraid the Yahoos in my own country are inclined towards similar behavior.
And yet you tell me that in your country the Yahoos are the masters and the Winnems the beasts of burden? How can that be?
What you fail to recognize is that in my country the Yahoos are civilized.
Civilized? What is civilized? So many of your words I don't understand. Lying, deceit, power, lust. But go on. Tell me, what is civilized?
Amongst us, we have wonderful things such as you Winnems have never dreamed of. Magnificent castles, gorgeous clothing, the noblest, most costly meats and drinks. Our ships go to the ends of the earth to bring these luxuries back for the rich.
Rich? What is rich?
A rich Yahoo is one who has enough money to buy these luxuries I described.
Then they are not free to all.
Oh, by no means.
How many of your Yahoos do enjoy them?
About one in every thousand, I should say. The bulk of our people live miserably by laboring every day for small wages.
Wages?
Money, the most prized and precious substance among them.
What you say amazes me. Tell me, those Yahoos who do not have the luxuries you describe, how do they feel?
Well, they are in continual ferment of endeavor to earn sufficient money to live as the rich do.
And of what does this endeavor consist?
Well, there are numerous kinds. Begging, robbing, stealing, cheating. Oh, then there are the recognized professions, of course, like doctoring.
Oh, please explain.
Well, it is part of our civilization that we eat when we're not hungry. A drink without provocation of thirst, and sit whole nights imbibing strong liquors.
Most extraordinary.
All of which inflames our bodies and prevents digestion. Then there are the diseases to which husbands and wives grown weary of their mates are subject to.
Incredible.
All of which makes the profession of doctoring a most lucrative one amongst us Yahoos. But I must tell you of another profession, the law.
Oh, please, spare me. I do not feel equal to hearing about the law today. To be frank, your whole discourse has only increased my abhorrence for the whole species of Yahoos. For the Yahoos amongst us, I have always felt a kind of pity for their ignorance. But the Yahoos of your country, you say, pretend to reason. Instead of reason, it seems to me you are possessed only of some quality fitted to increase your natural vices. Do you realize that for all your talk of civilization, all your fine words, you have never mentioned the one word we Winnems prize most deeply? Love.
Love.
It is the law of our land. We need no other. Amongst us, love is not confined to any particular object, but universal to the whole race. We show the same affection for our neighbor's issue as for our own, and wherever a Winnem goes, to whatever part of our land, he looks upon that as his home. Thus, we live together without conflict in peace and happiness. peace, happiness.
Now you are using words with which I am not familiar. But in time, dwelling amongst the Wynnums, I was to learn the full meaning of peace and happiness. I enjoyed perfect health of mind and body. I did not feel the treachery or inconstancy of a friend. Here was neither pickpocket, highwayman, buffoon, politician, wit. Here was no dungeon, no pride, vanity, or affectation. In the midst of all this happiness, and when I looked upon myself to be fully settled for life, my host sent for me one morning a little earlier than usual.
It is with great sorrow that I must tell you what I must. You will have to leave us.
Leave you? Go from this peaceful country? Oh, no. Not that. Don't send me away,
please. It is the opinion of the majority of the Wynnums that we jeopardize our well-being by keeping you here. It is feared that you, since you have the rudiments of reason added to the natural depravity of a Yahoo, that you may influence the other Yahoos to rise up against
us. A thought of that kind never entered my mind, I swear it. I'm happy here with you. I wish to live out the balance of my days without striving or conflict.
So I told the other Wynnums. But they replied that you yourself had told us that your kind excels in the art of lying and dissimulation. How can you be trusted? You must go.
The Wynnums allowed me the space of 2 months to build myself a boat. When the day came for my departure, my host, with several of his neighbors, escorted me to the shore. When the wind was right, I set my little sail. My host and the others continued on the shore till I was out of sight and far, far out to sea. With flowing tears and a heart sunk in grief, I heard their last farewell until it was drowned out by the pounding surf. Thus, gentle listener, I have given thee a faithful account of my travels for 16 years and above 7 months, wherein I have not been as studious of ornament as of truth. I could, perhaps, have astonished thee with strange and probable tales, but I chose to relate plain matter of fact in manner and style. It is my belief that a traveler's chief aim should be not to form wonderful descriptions of both land and sea, but to make men wiser and better.
Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift is another in a series of living fiction presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with the National Broadcasting Company. Adapted for radio by Frank Wells. The cast and directors were students of Northwestern University. Gulliver was played by Frederick Stein. The Lilliputian by Gene Williamson. The King of the Brobdingnagians by John Bowditch. The Wynnum by Stuart Mackey. Others were Ike Lacefield, Bruce Blythe, and Bill Scheffler. The assistant director was Bob Schneider. The director was Ace Gamble. The entire production was under the supervision of Howard Keegan, and this is Dick Noble. This is the NBC Radio Network.